Hello, everyone, and welcome to Let's Take a Stab at It. I'm your host, John Hoyer, and with me is...
Jason Bartsch, and I believe we have a special guest with us today, John, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it's a notable figure in the John and Jason collective. You know, you can talk now.
You didn't say my name.
You gotta say everyone. I'm notable figure in the John Jason collective.
The first time we did this, I thought he was gonna say my name as well, and then it just went to me. I was treading water, just trying to stay afloat. All right, we have writer, actor, producer.
Yeah. Oh God, no! Don't do that.
Appreciator of good chicken wings. Friend of the podcast, Liam Garrett.
Hi, everyone. Hey, my name's Liam Garrett. I'm really flattered to be here. Thank you so much. I love you guys, and I can't wait to cast these pods.
So, Liam, how long have we known you for? Since what, 2014, maybe?
Yeah, about 6 years, which is short time because we've only been making my my film/web series now together for, I mean, it's just a real quick 6 to 10 year shoot.
Yeah.
So, no. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I am on my third different camera since we started. Yeah. So like a little backstory.
You're in third marriage too.
Yeah. So a little backstory. I guess that's how the three of us really met, was on Liam's web series that he's producing. I acted as the director of photography, and John kind of wore a lot of hats. He was a director for an episode or two, and he's been doing a lot of the post-production. So Liam, do you want to tell everybody just a little bit about what the show's about and how they can stay connected?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. It's called Losing Liam, a title Jason chose that I initially hated and said so, but it stuck. It's basically what it is I in real life had a gastric sleeve surgery, and we thought, you know, there had been like a documentary series about people undergoing, you know, large weight loss. But as far as I knew, there was no scripted comedy where such a thing had happened. We've filmed 4 out of 6 parts, and what it is each segment is going to be me at a different weight, a journey in the weight loss, you know, gaining and losing, you know, this large amount of weight. Where initially the idea is we're going to put it out into film festivals as a episodic film cut into a feature. But then when we put it online, we think we're going to put it out as a web series, because just that'll be easier. I think when you go to a film festival, you'd rather watch a feature. And conversely, when you watch something online, you'd rather watch like a web series where you can just try an episode or two. And so, yeah, we're excited. We were going to try to finish it this year. Just there's been some delays.
Yeah.
Personal life stuff. And we actually, these two guys were with me filming pickup shots to finish like the pilot episode, just to polish that off. And with when we were making plans, like, all right, here we go. We're filming the final 2 parts. And then we heard this thing coming out of China. Apparently, a global shitstorm pandemic, if you will. And so that's kind of
that.
Yeah, it's called the carny virus, I think. It's it was started by Chinese carnies. I guess they have them there too. And it's spread through to American carnivals and then the general population. And
all right, and
now, oh, fuck, have, you, oh, there's gonna be a lot of this, Jason.
We have clearly,
buckle up.
We have clearly established that you need to be cut off at a certain point.
Okay,
so we just have to learn what that point is. Okay. No, but it's been great working on the show. I was initially just really drawn to the scripts, and I don't know. I love Liam's writing style. I know he said to not compliment him too much on the podcast, but the script is very good and it's very personal. It's very funny, and it's just been great to be involved in. And I think we've all grown as artists from the beginning. So not only has it been great to watch Liam's progress with his personal journey and the show and everything, it's also been great to see how we've all evolved as artists and collaborators as well.
Thanks, buddy.
I will say, though, as an editor, I feel like I've been great from the start. So I actually haven't learned anything.
Oh, you got worse. I'm sorry. I thought that was implied.
Your skills have deteriorated so much.
He doesn't give a shit anymore.
No, but I love you guys. You guys are the best. I'm just kind of glad just to get to shoot the shit with you guys tonight. This will be fun.
All right. So let's move on to what we've been watching. And Jason, why don't you start us off?
So I've been trying to stick within the horror genre since this is a horror podcast. This particular thing does still apply to the miniseries we've been doing about cults, and that's the miniseries called Waco. I know it's a couple years old at this point. I believe it originally aired on the Paramount Network, which I don't know who has that. That's one of those like mystery channels that you get to late at night where you've where you've passed all the music channels and it's up there somewhere. I don't know.
It's near Reels.
Yeah.
That's apparently a channel.
C-SPAN 3 or whatever.
Wasn't that Spike TV before, right?
Yeah, yeah. Spike TV became Paramount TV.
And then before that was TNN.
Oh, God, that's right. Holy shit.
But anyway, that the show originally aired on Paramount Network, and it was recently added to Netflix this year, where a lot of shows go to kind of get a second life. And it's really powerful. I think it might be 4 or 5 episodes. Taylor Kitsch and Michael Shannon are the leads, and they're both fantastic. It's a very well done miniseries. The final episode is one of the more powerful things I've ever seen on TV. It's just really heavy. I don't know. I definitely recommend it. It's not a happy thing to watch, but it really goes into detail. I was really young when all the stuff at Waco and the siege happened. I might have been like 4 or 5. So I kind of had a general idea of what went down there, but I had no idea the extent of it. And, you know, it got me reading more about it. And I don't know. I thought it was really well done, and it applied to the whole cult miniseries. So, yeah, check it out if you haven't. So, John, what have you been watching?
Yeah, so I watched a movie called Deep Red. It is a film by Dario Argento. I talked a little bit about it in our Suspiria episode, how I thought it was good, okay, kind of. I didn't seem that into it. And the cut I originally saw was like the original Italian cut, which is almost, it's like 2 hours and 8 minutes long. And basically, it was cut down to about 1 hour and 40 minutes for the American release. But because it was cut down for the American release, they never recorded English dialogue for the scenes that were cut. So in the original version, anytime they're talking and it cuts to Italian, you kind of know these are superfluous scenes. So it just felt very long and just drawn out, and I wasn't that into it. But in the American version, it goes at a very fast pace. I've seen people kind of describe it as being dumbed down version of the other film. But for me, it is nicer because it kind of just hints at things. So instead of it being like, oh, this really cheesy and not very well developed romance, is like, oh, there's a little flirtation, but that's all you get. So it ends up to me feeling a little bit more smarter in the way that it develops the characters and the set pieces and stuff, instead of being too overindulgent with it. I should say, so the kind of the plot of it is that a musician witnesses a murder in his building, and basically he gets his picture in the newspaper as being the witness to the murder. So then the killer starts coming after him, and it kind of goes from there. It's a little silly though, because usually, you know, if you're a witness to a murder, you don't just start investigating the murder yourself.
Wrong. No. I'd speak for yourself, pal. I sometimes do it before the murder's finished. I should be helping the person, but instead I'm like collecting blood samples and getting a big magnifying glass. But yeah. All right, I guess, you know, to each his own.
So anyway, so it's weird how editing can really help a movie feel like it is connecting with you better, even though it's less, like you're getting less time with the characters, but it tends to work. It just worked a lot better for me in the truncated version.
Sometimes less is more, folks. Liam, what have you been watching?
I was watching Pride and Prejudice, the Joe Wright version with Keira Knightley on Netflix. I just think it's so well done. She's so beautiful and charming in it. So I was watching that, and I was like, you know what? I always wanted to see Seeking a Friend for the End of the World with her and Steve Carell. I know it didn't get great reviews, but I thought that looked pretty, like, you know, heartwarming. So I threw that on, and man, I did not like that. I did not. It was just cloying. It was cliche. I didn't like the direction. It was kind of also from that period where Steve Carell was like, I'm going to show everyone how dramatic I can be. And so gave those super minimalist performances of where it was just like just one note moping the whole time. And
I saw that one when it came out, and I also wasn't a fan. And I feel like I would have been kind of the target market for it.
Being that you were like a little Garden State fanboy.
Yeah, sure. But yeah, I mean, I liked kind of the
you weren't.
I like the kind of like Dan in real life performance of Steve Carell, and it, I guess he's kind of like, you know, riding that wave. Yeah, I don't know. It was an interesting movie. Definitely not memorable. Underwhelming.
It was at the tail end, I think, of the manic. Was it a manic pixie dream girl phase?
Oh, yeah,
that was big in like, you know, the 2000s and into the early 2010s. And that was like, they clearly, like, I'm not sure how much it was that way on the page, but they definitely were kind of trying to steer Keira Knightley in that direction.
Yeah. And it just didn't click. None of it really clicked. And it seemed cool on paper, but yeah. No, I know what you're saying.
But anyway, yeah, didn't like it. I thought it was lame. Wouldn't recommend.
We might be going off track a little bit, but it's in the same genre. And it's also Keira Knightley. Have you ever seen Atonement?
Yeah.
That's a cool movie. That was one of...
That was Joe Wright again.
Yeah. I remember kind of in my earlier years of really getting into filmmaking, one of the first new movies that came out that I really paid attention to the cinematography. And I thought it had really beautiful cinematography. And I really enjoyed that movie. And it just made me think of it.
I haven't seen Pride and Prejudice or Atonement. And I, for some reason, think they're the same movie most of the time.
But is Joe Wright like really showing off a period piece with Keira Knightley?
Well, when Atonement came out, I was really all about The Departed winning all the awards. So any movie that was up against The Departed, I was like, fuck that movie. I don't care. Oh, Babel, you think you're going to get it? Not a chance, bitch.
But now you've come to love Inuyuritu.
I never go on long diatribes about how he sucks.
So tonight's film that we are discussing is Midsommar. So after the death of her family, Dani and her boyfriend Christian travel to Haga, a friend's isolated community in rural Sweden, to take part in the group's Midsommar festivities. The peaceful trip quickly turns dark when Dani and her group of friends become immersed in the rituals of the commune's pagan traditions. All right, so John, what did you think of this film?
So I fucking love this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great movie on a profound level. I think this film understands grief and human relationships really well. You know, for most horror films, sometimes you kind of let go of certain kind of like cliches and whatnot because of the genre, that it's mostly a delivery system of scares and visceral scenes or whatever. But I think this film actually works very well just as a movie on its own. I love how complicated Dani and Christian's relationship is. But I would also say that I think Ari Aster is just one of the best directors working today. I think the filmmaking on this is next level. The way he has characters in like a oneer where you see their reflection in a shot so you can see both persons' facial reactions to the other. It's just really impressive and amazing.
Yeah, I totally agree. Ari Aster just knocked it out of the park with this one, and Hereditary as well. One of the notes I wrote down as I was watching it is it's very deliberate. Everything he does is very deliberate. I even had a note that said economical shooting, which I don't know. We're so used to movies these days being so fast paced and kind of in your face. And when a director can kind of come up with an entire sequence that plays out seamlessly in one shot and convey so much information without anything being said, it's a real skill. It really is. And he does it just as good as anyone in the game today. And yeah, from a filmmaking perspective, I thought this film was brilliant, for sure.
It's interesting just how the setup of it doesn't exactly feel like a horror movie or anything. It's like a real tragedy of what happens.
Yeah, it's a drama, tragedy. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And it takes like her grief as like a real thing that is developed and dealt with throughout the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I similarly to both of you guys, I was pretty blown away because I loved Hereditary. I thought that was great. But this one, I felt like kind of when I first saw Oliver Stone's JFK, where that to me, that's like the most eminently engrossing movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like where I'm just like wrapped with attention the whole time, just because he just captures the like energy of a conspiracy, and where it feels like for a few hours, it feels like briefly, he figured out filmmaking and like Matt, like just knew exactly how to play all the strings. And I felt that way with, after having loved Hereditary, when I saw Midsommar, I just felt like just putty in Ari Aster's hands. Like he just, I felt like he just, like Jason said, so deliberate. and just so in control of every single aspect where like, I mean, I told you guys I wanted to do notes on the movie and I ended up having to do it like twice. Cause the first time I spent an hour and 45 minutes pouring over literally the first 7 minutes. Part of that is cause I'm, you know, I am what I am. And I know which one of those things is a very slow writer. And I also was kind of in love with my new 4K TV. And so I was just going back and pausing frames and transcribing little things written in the background.
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. And this is as good a movie as any to do what you did with it, to kind of go back and just, you know, pick apart the details and, you know, see it kind of in all of its glory on your new TV. You know, that's exciting.
Before we get into the plot of the film, I do want to bring up a correction to the very first episode of this podcast. I said that somebody referred to Hereditary as a 2-hour heart attack, and that person is Mr. Liam Garrett. And he yelled at me for not crediting him. So now I'm crediting him.
Damn straight, bitch.
I didn't know any of that. Yeah.
Squat on these nuts and recognize. Wow. I'm not being nice about it.
I immediately regret all of this.
I had no idea that was a Liam quote.
And yeah.
I'm even more surprised that Liam has listened to the podcast before tonight. That's
no, I've listened to a few episodes. I don't like podcasts, but I, sorry, I didn't say that.
And he especially doesn't
no
like
one,
us.
I think no one should listen to podcasts, just between you, me, and all your listeners. But
we said before the show that Liam's appearance on this is, podcast supervillain origin story. So
podcasts need to be destroyed and I would be the man to do it.
We already talked a little bit about Hereditary and Midsommar, and I don't know, I go back and forth on these. Like if I had to pick one, I think as far as like a true horror film goes, Hereditary has the edge, and it's certainly scarier, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, arguably some scenes are just as shocking, but then like, you know, you go to Midsommar and it's arguably a masterpiece as well. So it's, you know, it seems unfair to compare them, but how do you guys feel like they act as companion pieces?
So I think Hereditary, I think I'm with you on that it is a scarier film. I think that one kind of affects me more on like a visceral level.
Okay.
But I think Midsommar is a smarter movie. And I think the way that it deals with grief, I think that is very intelligent. I really enjoy seeing Danny's journey throughout the film.
Yeah.
I think it has a lot of good stuff to say about like interesting thoughts on relationships, and it shows a lot about how modern relationships deal in like subtleties of like the way someone says something, like characters being very passive aggressive towards one another, and reading into that and how that can be like, it deals a lot with like the anxieties of relationships.
Absolutely. And didn't Ari Aster say, you guys might know more than I do about this, but he was experiencing a breakup at the time of this show, and he wanted, or at the time of the film, and he mm-hmm. wanted to make a breakup movie, and he kind of ended up incorporating elements of his personal life into this and his own breakup.
He said that he identified that even though the Danny, the main character played by Florence Pugh, that was, you know, like based on a lot of experiences he had. He said he's also been in the Christian role as well in different relationships.
Mm-hmm. Which makes sense because in the film, you can see stuff from his perspective and hers. Obviously, she's more of a sympathetic character, but you can also understand from his perspective of, you know, like you're about to break up with a person and then something happens and like you would be a real turd if you were like, all right, you have nobody now. Bye.
Yeah.
I always hate it when I'm about to break up with a girl and her sister kills herself and their parents. It's like,
it's a tough time.
It's yeah. like, every time I'm about to get out of the relationship.
So many murder suicides.
So many murder suicides. And right as I'm about to do it. And it's like,
you have a bad track record. Yeah.
I can't help but think that it's me at a certain point.
It's probably you.
I can't help but think that like I make such a bad impression on the family that murder suicide is inevitable.
Folks, this is Liam at his most positive.
Jason, oh God, please tell them the thing, like, on, I think on our first set when we were shooting Losing Liam, uh-huh. what's the thing that I said to try to buck up the crew to, like,
oh, right, right. I think it was something along the lines of everything on the day was kind of just imploding. Nothing was right. going right. I don't know. Actors not showing, gear not working, whatever, you name it. You said something along the lines of, well, on the bright side, we'll all be dead someday anyway.
So. So at least we'll all, yeah, at least we'll all be dead someday.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, God, that does make me feel better, though, guys. Like, I'm like, ah, oh, at least I'll be able to rest in peace someday. Yeah.
All right, so let's get into the actual plot of the film. All right, so the opening of the film, we see the main character, Danny. She gets an ominous message from her sister, and she keeps calling her parents. We see a shot of the answering machine, and you see all the messages going up. So she's leaving a bunch of messages trying to get a hold of her parents, and she ends up calling her boyfriend, Christian, who is a, you know, a very understanding guy. Who tells her, just ignore all that, and you shouldn't care, because he just smoked, and he is getting pizza, so obviously, he is not ready for that conversation.
And you can tell this is something that has come up many times before in their, whatever, 4-plus-year relationship. And we touched on it a little bit earlier, but the relationship dynamic is just handled so well. It just feels real. Like it, mm-hmm. especially at the beginning, not so more after everything unravels later, but you can kind of empathize with both sides to a point. And I think that's yeah. where Ari Aster was coming from with, he felt like a little bit of himself was in Danny and Christian at some points. And because relationships, you know, especially breakups, they're not always just one-sided. There's a lot more to the story, but you can tell in this instance that Christian is just kind of like, oh, here we go again.
I will say, though, when I heard how he was talking to her, and then she goes, yeah, you're right. Yeah, I am making too much of this. I was like, she is very understanding.
Yeah, so at the beginning here, Florence Pugh does such a great job of conveying her anxiety. It's just so well acted. And if you've ever been around anyone who has anxiety, which I'm sure most of us have because it's so prevalent, a lot of us probably even have it ourselves, you know, just the things she's feeling, and you can just see her kind of internal strife going. And it's, I don't know if she got quite enough attention for this role as she maybe should have.
And well, also, like with the anxiety part, she also gets the idea of how something's bothering her, but also she feels bad that she knows that this is bothering her, and she doesn't want to be a burden to other people.
She feels so like she's a like burden.
Overthinking yep. that too, that maybe she's being too much for her friends, her loved ones, etc. So she gets off the phone with Christian, and you know, she calls one of her friends and starts talking to her friend about how she feels like Christian's planning to break up with her. He was kind of giving a weird vibe when she said, I love you. Which, it's interesting because the context of him being at a pizza place high with his guy friends, he might not be, you know, inclined to want to be like, I love you so much, baby. So like,
well, as we find out shortly, his friends are not a fan of Danny.
No, and it's not. I don't know if they even really dislike her so much as that they are dealing with him complaining about her.
They dislike the person that she makes Christian become.
Yes.
Yeah, but I have so many thoughts on this, but I should clam up right now, right?
Yeah, you just, when you have thoughts, you just don't say anything. That's how podcasts go.
No, but I
chime
thought
in, Liam.
I thought we were just recapping it, but like, we're okay. All right, so yeah, I think we've all had that anxiety where we see like a guy friend from both angles, like, because, you know, Christian is, I mean, we're going to talk about this more, but he is a gigantic shithead. Like, he is an awful human being. And we've seen that, like, I think we've all seen, like, just like a buddy of ours who seems like a real cool guy, but who's just like really, really not attending to like his woman's emotional needs at all. And like clearly playing mind games with her and gaslighting her to like mm-hmm. get her to leave him alone. And conversely, I mean, I've definitely had the opposite, where I've had like totally nice guy friends who are there for their ladies. But the person they happen to be with is just like very, very paranoid and needy. And well, clearly, like, I mean, I've been like, I remember this one instance where like my friend had this totally like kind of like basket case. We're having a night out and she cried for three different reasons, where she was just clearly taking little things he said. Like, she would like, oh, so what you mean is, and she would twist it, and it was clear what she was doing was he would then be like very like fawning over her and like accommodating her. And it was clear like this weird power struggle game where she was using like her upsetness, which you get the feeling that maybe Christian and like his friends, they think Danny's doing that to him.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's hard to suss out.
But it feels like a very modern relationship though, because of how the thing is, aside from the story you were just pointing about it being a little more direct, a lot of times in relationships, it's people don't want to seem like the bad guy. So if they're unhappy or whatever, they would rather have the other person kind of want to end things or want to like end the relationship or whatever. So they will do certain things that I wouldn't say are overt, but maybe unconscious. I think how society is nowadays, it's like no one wants to deal with maybe another person directly being upset or crying at them. So it's like months of people being like, right, just, you know, hinting that they're unhappy, or
maybe we should think about seeing other people, maybe, which is like such a, I want to break up with you line, but it's like, I want to break up.
I need space.
I want you to do it. So I'm going to keep making irrational demands of you until you break up with me. Like,
I think this conversation alone is a testament to how proficient of a director Ari Aster is and how great the actors were being able to get us to discuss all of this in the first, whatever, 5 to 7 minutes of the film. Like, we already have come to these conclusions about these characters.
So I think aside from like, so a lot of this stuff is developed from like what is being stated by the characters. But as Liam was discussing earlier, he had, what did you said you spent like an hour and a half work going through the first 7 minutes. And you were saying you had some good details about some of the background and stuff, but maybe you want to chime in on that?
Yeah. No, I don't usually go so nuts. I'm not like, well, I guess it depends on what we're talking. Okay, I'm sorry. I am what I am. But just like some things, like, so when I was poring over it, there's so much detail because, I mean, Ari Aster is, you know, he's, you know, a perfectionist. Like, even just the fact her name's Danielle. Danielle comes from the Hebrew for only God can judge me. But something I found was interesting is the email at the beginning says, "Hi, Danny." And then Mark, who's high on the other end of the phone, keeps saying, "Hi, Danny. Hi, Danny. Hi, Danny." And I look that up, and like a "Hi, Denis" is actually a name that, like, depending on, you know, like, I know the Kabbalarian philosophy, we're saying that the name "Hi, Denis" creates a dual nature, and that you can be very generous and understanding, but you can also be so candid in your expression that you create misunderstanding. And just the fact that her name's her last name's Ardor, which we know that's usually deals with passion. That comes from the Latin to burn, which which is the ending of the film.
Yeah.
So that's with a guy like Ari Aster, like, we can get into the whole like intentional fallacy debate and new criticism, and the author is dead and whatnot. But like, he has so much information there; it's hard not to consider his authorial intent in all these things.
Yeah,
something that I also thought was even the first time we see Danny's head is it's in a sharp silhouette. And when she turns around, we see behind her is all over her apartment, which I didn't notice until I watched the 7 minutes. Almost every shot has a dying plant in it, just like behind her, in the background, in the foreground. And then also as she then sits down and the camera comes down with her, we see behind her very noticeably, because it's kind of the way it's lit, and the chair pulled away from her kitchen table and then empty dishes on it. And then later we see her like taking some anti-anxiety pills, and right there you just have, and we see that in the reflection of her microwave, no less. And like we'll see later, the idea that her table is empty and she's taking these other kind of like drugs all by herself, where later on she'll be at this feast in the ceremony where they're all eating together at one big table, and she's ingested some hallucinogenics but like communally with these people. And likewise, even her Christian, when she calls him, he's high and ordering pizza with a friend. And then that's just like a tiny bit.
Yeah, what's going on. There's the detail too, where when we first see her parents, and we have that like kind of panning shot as they're sleeping, and you see the picture frame of Danny, and it's kind of covered in flowers, you know.
And their bedding and their wallpaper is all yellow or gold, but I think yellowing like vines and flowers and leaves, which you would think that means they're, you know, probably like, perhaps dead.
Yeah.
Flowers and leaves. Yeah.
We might as well get to this at this point. What ends up happening is this time her sister was not crying wolf with her suicide attempt, and she does end up taking her own life and the life of their parents. And it's just this really insane scene, this montage of her suicide. She kind of hooked these hoses up to the exhaust pipes of the cars in the garage, turned them both on, and they're running up the stairs. Two of them are duct taped under her parents' room, and one is duct taped on to her face. And it's I don't know about you guys, that's one of the most memorable things I've ever seen in cinema.
Yeah,
hands down.
Yeah, the shot of her face, which is like the end of that sequence. And I believe you see that, the look on her face, you see it a few times in the movie.
It pops up throughout the film, yeah.
One of the big scenes that kind of, I think, really drives home like the dynamic between Danny and Christian is when they go to a party. Danny doesn't want to go, but she ends up just going because Christian's going and she doesn't want to be alone. And that's when she finds out that Christian and all his other anthropology majors are going to the Midsummer in Sweden.
That scene is so painful. He's such a shithead.
Yeah, and it's so weird though, because it's like he can't even say yes, I'm going.
Yeah, he's like, I was thinking about it.
I was thinking about it. Yeah, you
it's
know,
like, they're like, dude, it's like next week or two weeks.
it's two weeks.
Didn't she say, did you buy tickets?
Yeah,
and then it's like,
you already bought your plane ticket.
Yeah, and so it continues from that scene to Danny's apartment, and it's just so. It doesn't really come to a full argument even, but like, it's like, he's like, oh, I don't want to deal with this. I'm going to go. And she's like, wait, don't go. I'm sorry. And she apologizes for everything. And, you know, it's pretty justifiable that she's like, I think all she was saying is like, no, it's cool that you're going. Like, I don't care. But it's just weird you didn't tell me.
He's like so emotionally unavailable at this point and just kind of blocked off that he's not even like indulging any of these fights. He's just kind of like shut down to it. He's like relenting without really taking any blame and just kind of like brushing it under the rug.
Like what Liam was saying, it's very painful to watch. And I mean, I'm a person who I can't deal with like indirect stuff. So like, I'd almost want to be like, Christian, what is your problem? You know, like I would want to like push at that.
Well, he's such a coward.
Yes. That is such a good, yeah.
He can tell that the balance of power there, that she doesn't want him to leave. And he knows that if she calls him out, he'll have an excuse to leave. So he says all these bullshitty things kind of almost like as a bluff. It's like, yeah, this is transparently a lie. Like this is of course bullshit, but I'm going to dare you to call me out on it, because you know then that you'll lose me. So it's like this sick little game where he says obvious, like he's saying the sky is purple, and he knows that she has to be like, you bet it is, babe. I'm sorry I ever said it was blue.
I don't think though that he's completely conscious of this as much as because he is like just a full on dum dum, and just
what you see there is you see the psychologies and their behavioral manifestations, and yet they're not having an actual conversation about the real things they're thinking. Mm-hmm. They're just sort of inflicting their behaviors on each other, like almost as like a fucking contest. And it's so painful to watch.
So the next scene we see is Christian is at his apartment, and we hear that Danny is coming up the steps. So he lets known to his friends that he invited Danny to the Sweden trip, that she's not going, but she said yes, that she'll go, but she's not going.
Yeah, he keeps assuring them she's not coming. And he says it, what,
a few
15
times.
Seconds before she walks in the door?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's funny, and all his friends nod agreeably. There's even no though you can time. Tell in their eyes, they're like, oh, you fucking did it. You fucking did it.
And like, he says to them, and I told her it was your idea.
That's the last thing he says, like right before the door opens.
She comes right in, and then she's like, hi. And then one by one, they're like, oh, Christian, could I speak to you about this edit in the other room? So it eventually devolves into just Danny and Pele hanging out. And guys, I don't know if you picked up on this, but I think Pele has the hots for Danny.
Jonathan? Oh my god.
Wow.
You mean in a biblical sense? Like erotically perhaps?
I think so.
Man, he just topped all of the subtleties you picked up on.
Wow. I am clutching my, you can't see this, but I am clutching my pearls so hard right now. So, luckily, I had already repaired to my fainting couch, so I didn't hit the floor. But
he's kind of like the nice guy from Sweden, the sensitive guy. And he might take his sensitivity a little too far in the scene, because he brings up her parents, and he was like, oh, my parents died when I was little too, and you know, that kind of triggers some emotions for her.
I know that he is doing some manipulating with her, but I don't know that he, I believe him when he's like, he feels a connection to her about what was going on.
Yeah, I think he does genuinely like her. And then after all, I mean, you know, when she does become the May Queen, it's like, it's not like he's actually trying to hurt her. Like he does think he's helping her.
Do you think that was the moment when he realized she could be a good May Queen?
I think so.
I think so as well. Because I was trying to look out for that this time watching it, and you can kind of see like the wheels spinning a little bit. I think that might be the moment. And yeah, I don't know. Like, how is that like rigged that the outsider becomes the May Queen? Like, I guess we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, let's table that. So he brings up her family's death, and she immediately has a panic attack. She runs into the bathroom, and it kind of jump cuts to, oh, she's in the bathroom of a plane. And yeah.
And once again, hiding her emotions.
Yes.
It's a really cool shot. It's from overhead, and you follow her into the bathroom at the apartment. And we kind of have this invisible cut where she's now in a plane. Another, you know, brilliant transition.
They get in the car, and they eventually make it to, it's not quite the village yet, but they're hanging out.
The pre-village.
Yeah.
It all looks very similar. It's like fields and picturesque.
Yeah, it's where they leave their like cars and shit, I guess.
The director's cut, they add a lot more to the car ride over, and they have a really interesting conversation in the car ride, but the pacing is better without it, where they just end up pretty much right at the village.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So yeah, they get there, and they Pele kind of introduces everybody to all his friends from home, and they all take mushrooms, and they all start tripping.
Pretty. And then even they couldn't even do that without having like a passive aggressive, like, oh yeah, we're she doesn't want to do it, so we're not going to do it. And so she has to be like, okay, I'll do drugs.
Yeah.
That like annoyed the shit out of me watching that, because it's like, she doesn't want to be the bad guy who's like making her boyfriend sit out the fun with her, with his friends. And then he's like, oh no, but I'll wait for you. And it's this back and forth until she's like, you know what? I'll do it just so that way I don't seem lame and ruining the fun of everyone. But then she knew that she was going to have a bad trip. I hate that scene, actually.
It's because it's not simple. It's not so simple. People want to simplify it and say, oh, she should have just said, guys, I don't want to. Let me ruin everyone's fun.
Yeah.
Like, it's like to have a communal experience, you all got to buy into it. So it is like this friction, like natural friction of like individual choice and communal choice. Like, it's so unbearable because I'm not quite sure what she should have done, to be honest.
I guess I see from her perspective a lot more on that, because it's like,
totally.
Well, for instance, so when I lived in Philly, I went to a few Temple football games, and it was like everyone would be like tailgating early in the morning. I don't like getting up early in the morning in general. So Everyone's up at like 7 in the morning or whatever, and they're getting shit-faced, and I kind of just want to have some coffee or breakfast food.
Into your day.
Yeah. I want to like kind of be up a little bit first,
and then get shit faced.
Yeah.
So, well, that's what Danny said. She was like, you know, I just want to get comfortable first. I forget how she phrased it. You know, I just want to settle in. Yeah.
I think that's pretty reasonable. And the bros are like, yo, let's go. Let's get it done.
Do you think that Mark gaslights Christian as much as Christian gaslights Danny? Because like, Mark's always the one that's like, it's like, dude, come on, what are you doing, man? Like,
well, first of all, his real name is the Don't Go Chasing Waterfalls kid from We Are the Millers.
Oh yeah.
he's the kid who sings that song in all the trailers.
He's also plays a convincingly racist cop in Detroit.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? There's something wrong with his eyes. I'm sorry. There's something wrong with the way his face is shaped. Wow. And that's just, we can talk about his acting and whatnot, but he's, boy's got a weird face.
His face isn't right.
No, it's wrong. Face is all wrong.
It's all wrong.
And it makes him good at playing like oddball characters. And that's actually something we even brought up, is the movie is so funny.
Oh,
and like Mark being an asshole, which the movie didn't have to be, but it was such a nice little gift from the filmmakers to us that they're like, oh no, we'll give you some things to chuckle at, including Mark just being a dickweed.
Yeah, but Mark's certainly the comic relief in the film. How much of that do you guys think was added in post? Because a lot of his little one-liners are off camera. And some of them,
I didn't notice that.
Some of them felt kind of added, like,
they
were like, oh, we got to make this a little funnier. Mark's kind of a dick. He could have a funny line here. If you notice, a lot of the little jabs he has are off camera.
I think also an interesting aspect of his character is that he's always like saying shit to Christian, like, come on, dude. Like, he's really trying to alpha him. But the whole movie, he complains about the most inane, like, baby shit. Like, he's like, is there a lot of ticks here? There's a lot of ticks here. I don't like ticks. And
it's like, I remember like some guy who was like, he was the equipment manager for like the college rugby team. Mm-hmm. And yet he had a little Napoleonic complex where he was like the most bro-y out of all of them. He's like, fucking chicks, dude. Am I right? Yeah. So I equipment manager for the rugby team. Do you know what rugby is? Imagine football without the pads. That's how hardcore it is. I'm like, yeah, you don't do that, right? Like, that's not what you do.
Referring to the whole tick thing, too, that's another line that the one night as they're all going to bed, you just hear Mark say, if you check me for ticks, I'll check you. And it's just kind of like, it's like right before the scene ends. I was like, that could have just been added in post. I don't know.
Well, also, like, the way he talks about, like, the girls that he sees, he's like, oh my god, like, this place is amazing. And
yeah,
but then when he's like, actually, like, the one girl comes up to him later, his cockiness is gone. Like, it's all talk. Everyone knows that kind of guy.
He's a weenie, you would say, right? We don't hand out that term lightly on the show. We've only coined one or two previous weenies, I think.
Yeah.
Am I on a weenie episode? Whoa.
Wow. Weenie alert.
What if we start doing that as like the morning zoo kind of thing?
Yeah, like, guys,
I love it if you guys had sound effects.
We got a weenie.
Weenie.
Yeah, Christian and what's his name, Mark are both weenies.
Well, so let's get back to the plot of this. So they end up getting to Pels or Pele's village. Wait, Liam, just what would you?
I think it's pronounced Zarathustra. I thought it was Pele.
Pele,
you're right. Pele, I think I would have noticed because that's the most famous soccer player.
Okay,
of all time.
So we're gonna say Pele. I'm gonna say Pele now. Pele.
Thank you.
We found it one of the previous episodes. I was saying the name of something wrong for about 10 minutes. And then when I asked Jason, am I saying that right? He corrected me. And then I was like, so I was just talking like an idiot for 10 minutes.
By the way, it probably is Pele and I'll look like a dick. Pele. So whatever.
All right. So they go to the village and they meet everybody. Pele remembers Danny's birthday and Christian doesn't.
Yeah.
Then Pele tells Christian, I'm like, hey, I'm just letting you know it's Danny's birthday.
That's like an interesting move by Pele too. It's kind of like a subtle big time with Christian. It's like, I don't know. It's like,
I think because I do think that even though there is manipulation going on there as it goes on, but I do think he does care about her. And that's why that moment of him telling Christian is because he doesn't want her. He doesn't want her to feel sad.
He really believe whatever Christian comes up with is like, she's going to buy it that he remembered?
I think he was just being a good bro.
Yeah.
Man. You just got to let your bro know, yo, it's your chick's birthday, man.
We're going to make sure you're dead later. So like, why not? You know, I'm going to help you beforehand.
Christian like takes her outside. He's like, oh, got a little surprise for you cooking that I've definitely been planning for a long time. And it's this little slice of cake with a candle that he can't get to light, which is an amazing detail.
So, so I will say, I think it was cute, but the fact that he keeps trying to light it and then she just goes, to stop. Like, she's like, this is fake.
Metaphor for their relationship. Yeah. He can't get it to light. I love that detail. The first time I saw it, I remembered it and then watched it again.
Well, I took that to mean, as I take all movies to mean, as a metaphor for not being able to perform sexually. And that's usually where my conclusion when I analyze a movie is that this is about being impotent, which I may or may not be. That's irrelevant. I don't like any aspersions being cast my way.
I feel like, Liam, if we had a scene like that in your show where a lighter didn't light, you would demand getting an actual lighter that didn't light rather than pretending the lighter didn't light. You'd be like, we have to find a lighter that won't light.
Fuck you, Jason.
Let's get into the what's it called? Etestupa scene. So
that's how I would
Etestupa.
Etestupa.
They go to this big celebration where there's
the Etestupa.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
So they get to this scene and there are these two old people that are dressed in like gray clothes and everyone else is in white. And, you know, they're eating, they're having a little bit of a celebration. And then they're like, okay, let's all go to that very odd looking cliff and let's go to the bottom of that. And we're like, well, I feel like we know what's going to happen.
They're going to hock a luge.
What are they doing standing up there? And then the lady jumps and they're like, oh my God. And they're traumatized by it. And unfortunately, the guy jumps and he does not land right.
Dumbass.
His form is not great.
No, it's terrible.
Not as good as he, his ladies.
Yeah, he totally.
At least do a flip, right? Like, so then they have people come out with the special mallet that they use.
that's literally true. Yeah.
And they take turns smashing that head.
That's in my living will.
Yeah.
That's an advanced directive I have, is when the time of death is called, I want the doctor to smash my head in with a croquet mallet.
Yeah.
Just to make sure I'm really out.
Actually, for my will, for my directions of when I die, I want to be stuffed and placed in Jason's living room. So,
agreed.
So
I'll do that.
We'll talk about that after the episode. We'll see what we can make happen.
I'm volunteering. I'll do it.
All right. So the main aspect of this scene that's important is that all the characters that are from America are pretty outraged and upset by it. And the other part that I think is worth noting is that when the guy jumps and is still alive, he's like in pain, obviously. And then everyone else starts screaming in pain too. So mm-hmm. You're now seeing that his pain is their pain. They are kind of yelling and screaming with him. So that way he feels like almost like a connection with that. And I think that's something that I think Danny notices. And we know that because the whole scene of when they jump, all the sound is from her perspective of what she hears and sees.
Oh, that's interesting.
So we have like all the sound kind of drowns out at first, and then it starts pulling in of like people screaming and like, what's going on and whatever, whatever. And you see from her perspective looking at the other couple that's there. And when they start screaming, she takes note of that. And I think that's a very important kind of scene where she is traumatized by what she saw, but also that's like an interesting concept to her.
Yeah, that's something that she doesn't get a lot of. Is someone being on board with her extreme emotions. And mm-hmm. like she's seeing that in this community. And yeah, like you said, the sound design is just brilliant in conveying all that. I think it's safe to say that she's pretty shocked in this scene, but mm-hmm. I think the whole kind of idea of this communal suffering, you know, she warms up to it.
So after that event occurs, Christian decides to and tells Josh, like, hey, you know, just letting you know, like, I'm going to be doing my thesis on this place too. So, like, before, you know, you hear it from anyone else.
Yeah, he's doing it.
I want to do the right thing.
Yeah, I'm going to do the right thing and then say, I'm stealing your idea. And, you know, if you want to collaborate, I'm down for that, you know. So that's, you know, Josh isn't happy. He's pretty mad about it, justifiably.
He's the main reason they're there.
Yeah, he's taking it seriously.
I was going to say, in the theatrical cut, Christian just seems like he's more just there for the ride like Mark is. Mm-hmm. But then in the director's cut, you see him, they have some scenes of him like asking people from the commune about like some of their stuff going on. And you can kind of see that he is like, this is like an area, you know, of some interest for him. And that he is like, you kind of see the germination of him deciding to like do, you know, his thesis on there.
So it's not as out of the blue. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I don't think was necessary, but it was interesting.
But that is like kind of true to his character, that he's not an intentionally malicious person. He's just a fool.
You totally buy it that he would do that.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Without any kind of malicious intent. He's just kind of like, you know.
You don't really have that though in movies though, because usually they're either intentionally malicious or like
almost a sympathetic fool, whereas he's not one of those. Yeah.
But like he's like a complicated person that's somewhere like in between. Like some things are kind of like might be malicious, other stuff he's just being absent-minded.
Yeah, he's also like he's really obvious about it in this case, because like the craziest thing they've probably all ever witnessed in their lives just happened.
Yeah.
And he's just casually like, yeah, you know,
I've been thinking about it. And, you know, since we're here, I think I'm going to just do my thesis. And then he tries to like deflect and be like, well, you're going to go to Germany and wherever and look at all these other places. I'm just going to look at here.
So like Jason and Liam know I'm not like the most well-read person. And probably if there's anything in film related stuff, that writing is probably like the aspect that I'm probably, it's not my thing, you know. I might have good ideas, whatever, but like this would be the equivalent of like me telling Liam, you know, I was thinking I'm gonna write a novel, you know, and you would just be like, what?
No, you're not.
I mean, I'm like, I'm sorry, I've been scratching my ears. Did you say you're gonna read a novel? Because I know you didn't say right.
Well, so Danny's packing up her stuff. Pelly comes in and tries to talk her out of it. And we get a little bit more info about how this community really had helped him when his parents died at a young age. And I think this is a pretty heartfelt scene. Then he holds her hand, right?
Yeah.
That's the big moment. And she's like, whoa, a Christian might walk in. And he says something to the effect of, Danny, do you feel held by him? Does he feel like home to you?
Yeah.
I think that's a really like key scene. I think it's like a very kind of poetic way that he says that too. Like that he does care about her. And obviously Christian's just a giant fucking dope.
Right. And he also mentions there how his parents died in a fire, which could have been one of the rituals.
I was wondering about that but the ritual we see though is every 90 years.
The end. The burning of the chapel is only every 90 years.
Yeah.
The rest of it, Ari Aster says he meant to imply happens every year.
Oh, the killing of...
Oh, I don't know about the killing. Oh, you know what, though? That's up for debate. That was... Because he wasn't quite clear about that in his Reddit Ask Me Anything. So people, because some people were thinking that happened only every 18 years, the old people killing themselves. I'm not sure.
And the next thing we see is Danny has some crazy dreams about she's sleeping. She wakes up in the dream and everyone's like leaving her and they're getting in the car and driving off. The exhaust from the car kind of fills the frame and then comes out of her mouth. And then she imagines the visuals of her dead family. And then they're in the place where the old people a few scenes earlier jumped off that cliff onto that rock.
Yeah.
So it places them there and she freaks out. And I think that's kind of, it's a good visual way of expressing, like, she does feel that they're going to abandon her. She's not fitting in with them.
Yeah. She's feeling kind of a separation from them too. Like, you know, cause this was right after like Pelly kind of expressed like his true emotions towards her. So I think whether she wants to admit it or not, she's actually starting to feel a draw to this place.
Yeah.
So it could represent that as well.
So that scene is the same night that this little redhead, Maya, leaves something under Christian's bed. And we learn that it is, this girl likes Christian, and that's supposed to be a little love spell.
And then later, I mean, do you mind if we skip ahead and say what she does then later?
Yeah, go for it.
She leaves him a literal hair pie, or fur pie. She puts a pube in something he's eating, I guess as some sort of like enchantment into it. Let me just say, I want to actually go on the record on this. Ladies, stop doing that.
No.
Stop. I just want to go to one potluck dinner where I don't have like some girl, like, you know, some lady falling in love with me, putting her pubes in my food.
He thinks that they're doing that, but really he's accidentally eating his beard.
I eat like three strands of my hair. And I'm like, ladies, come on. Just
what's up with all these brunettes trying to get with me?
With their long, sometimes gray pubic hair. I mean, come on, grandma. Like, just ask for my digits. Don't.
It's good advice. We give out good advice here on the podcast.
All right. So Liam relates to that.
Yeah.
If we're going to talk about something I relate to on a certain profound level, it's when Mark pisses on an ancestral tree and they hate him because of that. And
that is a John move.
That's like something that would happen to me. You know, unintentionally.
You would probably take a shit. You would probably take a big, awful shit.
So there is a second group that is not from the commune. So Connie and Simon. And after we see the old people killing themselves, Connie and Simon, they take it the worst out of anybody. They are very upset by this.
They get really bent out of shape.
Yeah, yeah. Like, come on, calm down. Who hasn't seen a ritualistic suicide? Come on. Like, come on. Connie goes to pack up stuff, and then they're like, hey, you know, Simon left already. She's like, what? He wouldn't do that. So she's upset. She tells the American crew about it. And Danny's like, I could see Christian doing that to me.
Well, she says it to him.
Yeah. And she then
says, I could see you doing that.
Yeah. He goes, like, what does that mean?
So shocked. While at the same time, he's probably thinking, like, how do I do that?
Like, that's an idea that you can do? Oh my God. He's probably thinking, like, man, that's Simon. He's got some balls on him.
This is all part of Danny's kind of growing process and her kind of immersing herself in this community and just...
Yeah, she's back talking a little with
through,
him.
Yeah, through all of this, she's realizing some of the shitty things that Christian does. And,
yeah.
You know, she calls him out. I think it's the first time in the film that she kind of blatantly calls him out.
Yeah, she's really starting to like be more forthright. And this is also a really important part of the movie in that this is when the real horror movie template kicks in, the framework of like, and then there were none,
mm-hmm.
the Agatha Christie book, which is, you know, yeah. the highest selling mystery of all time, where you then have the framework of, all right, now we're going to start eliminating character by character by character. And this is actually, I've seen some people, like when they say Hereditary was better, they say Hereditary had a plot that really kept you guessing. It wasn't formulaic, but Midsommar, it's like, oh, okay, here comes the standard plot now mm-hmm. where each person is dispatched increasingly in an increasingly gruesome way. But what I found, the interesting juxtaposition, I would say, I think that I found between Hereditary and Midsommar is both of them, what works so well about them, what makes them like great slow burn horror movies, is that they actually use it artfully, the slow burn effect, to talk about different kinds of dread.
Mm-hmm.
And so with Hereditary, it was the dreading of continuing like a legacy, a familial legacy of dysfunction and mental illness. Whereas in Midsommar, the dread is more of like what's coming in a relationship. Like you can see it's ending, it's dysfunctional. And yet you're each going, instead of just, you know, owning up to it and ending it or being honest with each other, you're going to keep just sort of inflicting your behaviors on each other and passive aggressions on each other. And if you're watching from the outside as a friend, it's like a nightmare. It's like, oh God, just break up already.
It's also how they see these weird things happening at the commune, but they don't want to offend anybody.
Right.
Like, we have to leave. We have to get out of here. This scene,
which is always in the movies. You're always like, why don't you fucking leave? Yeah. Get out of the house. And it's always like that weird, you have something keeping you there. Mm-hmm. And what I thought was used artfully is that sort of cliche framework, that sort of sometimes that dread of, oh, here we go, here's where they start eliminating it character by character, that recreates to me the experience of being like, oh, here we go, here goes, you know, the death throes of a relationship where you guys get more and more passive aggressive with each other. And like that actually, like that's where, you know, I'm usually, genre films aren't my favorite films, but this is the time where I felt like the genre conventions were used in an artful method to actually recreate within the viewer just that dread of what's to come. Like, oh, because you know they're not gonna learn their lesson in time. They're not gonna be like, hey, a couple of our friends have disappeared, two's enough, we're gonna leave now. They're gonna always come up with some dumb excuse. And so like that actually, the formulaic nature of the rest of the plot, up and of course just the plot points were formulaic, not the actual what fucking happened, which is of course is bug fucking it blew everyone's minds at how weird it was. Mm-hmm. But the formulaic nature of the plot points actually served the overall artistic effect of recreating within you that dread.
Yeah, and I think it dodges the cliche a little bit by not focusing on how they died and how they were killed. Mm-hmm. You know, we do see one death, which is Josh's death. Womp womp. He's the one who is there doing his actual thesis on these people, and Christian kind of rides his coattails. And in the process of doing this, he's very interested in the sacred texts of these mm-hmm. people, and we come to learn that they are written by this inbred child named Reuben, and they use inbred people to write these texts because they don't have clouded thoughts. I forget exactly how they phrase it, something along those lines of, you know, their judgment's not clouded. So this kid, he draws these pictures, and then the elders interpreted, I guess, is kind of how it works. And Josh really wants to see that. But of course, it's off limits. It's got to be. And, you know, he kind of wanders into the temple one night just to snap a few pictures of it and look at it, but not so fast. Gets hit in the head. He's dead.
He thinks he sees Mark, and it turns out Reuben actually has Mark's face pulled over his own. So
he is wearing Mark's face.
Yeah.
And or entire body.
I think the script implies it's the entire body. And the script also makes clear, shout out to my friend Amanda for pointing out to me that it's actually, it is in fact Josh who is the one that's moaning and groaning, which on the floor. And that makes that scene so much ickier.
My thing is like, were they going to kill Josh anyway? They just picked this opportunity. Because like Mark, they kind of lure him with one of the Swedish girls and, you know, he was an easy kill, I assume.
And he pissed on things, you know?
Yeah.
He's my boy.
That one was a no-brainer.
Well, that's I think, part of a deeper question of, like, was the cult, if everyone had joined the cult and been good boys, would the cult been like, great, yeah, we're all, you know, we're glad to have you.
They talk about how they need to bring in outsiders to breed because there's too much incest. So like, shouldn't they be pretty open-minded to get to like anybody? Well, like, why not all three of them? Why not all three of the visitors?
So they said, it seems like, so they needed four people outsiders, four people that lived in the community, than one person that's the choice of the May Queen. All the people that were going to be killed would be accounted for except Danny. So Danny coming was not the intended plan.
So Danny was kind of just the wild card here. Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, Pelly was kind of sweet on her. So, you know, why not bring her along? You know,
yeah.
who knows what could happen? Maybe her being the May Queen was a happy accident, you know?
So Danny goes with the women and that goes off with them, and she drinks some psychedelic drink that looked delicious, and they go and do the maypole dance. All right, what do you guys think? Do you think they cheated to let her win? Or not cheated, but do you think they allowed her to win, or did she just win on her own?
I assumed she won, but I have no idea.
That's a big question I had. Like, it wouldn't change a whole lot if she didn't win. And she wasn't even really supposed to come. So I don't, maybe she just happens to win.
Maybe they sense from her that she needs to kind of be the center of attention to some degree, or to feel like it.
Maybe they kind of, yeah, they got her on the line a little bit, and they're like, you know, if she wins this thing, she might just stay here.
But also, it's a perfect way to evaluate and see, is she going to choose the community or her boyfriend? You know she's in if she chooses the boyfriend. And so she does the maypole dance, you know, and Christian meets with a matchmaker while this is going on, and the matchmaker says, oh, you have been approved to mate with Maya. He doesn't really give any sort of like, yeah, sure, or no way,
please inseminate our ginger.
Yeah, it's just like, he's just like, what you know, like,
what would your reaction be
if I was,
let's improvise it. Hey John, thank you for coming. We've all talked about it. We would like you to ply your seed to our potentially underage, let's just say of age, redhead. Your thoughts?
No, I'm dating Danny and she's cool.
Interesting. I would have been like, cowabunga, dude.
I would have been dead long ago. I would have been Joshua.
So she tells him, he's like, you don't see a reaction really, or you don't see him say anything. He just leaves in kind of a daze. And then they give him something to drink. He's getting weird with it, just vibing.
Right.
And Danny gets pulled away because they need her to do some ceremony stuff.
Yeah, she's like, bless the crops. Yeah. Something.
So they pull Christian aside and like, hey, follow all these flowers. We made a little path for you. And when he goes to the sex barn, Maya's there. And then they give him, they make him breathe in something for quote unquote vitality. And then he goes to town with Maya, and there are all these naked women there. Remember, Jason on the podcast has remarked how much he loves cults that are filled with a bunch of naked people.
Yeah, so we're keeping a tally. That's score one for the naked column.
Yeah, they're all like in a semicircle there to like cheerlead him, like getting froggy.
They're
with
helping
their redhead. Yeah.
Yeah, they are assisting.
They're helping him thrust. He is not doing a good enough job.
Well, they're
not
all taking turns. There's just one. There's clearly the thrust helper lady. That's like her assigned duty. Which for me and John, that's Jason. is John, because John and I were both John and I, we separately. when John's with his ladies and I'm with my ladies. Separate events. John and I,
together.
No, come on. Guys, don't make this a sordid affair. Anyway, when Jason's helping me physically have sex with women, usually it's I'm out of shape. And, you know, usually the woman's a little bit freaked out that Jason's there. I don't always clear it with them ahead of time. I forget. I'm absent-minded. But when they, first of all, when they see how nice Jason is and they see the benefits of him helping me get some torque, like in my thrusts, then they're like, oh, okay, this was a good call by me. But yeah, in this cult scenario, weird.
Yeah, so all the people that are there helping with the sex, they're moaning along with the characters, because they're again, like, as a group, are like feeding into that, like, kind of collective emotion or whatever.
Yeah, communal, like, emotional experience, mimicry. Yeah.
So then Danny's like, oh, what's in that sex barn? They're like, you don't want to know. She's like, all right, well, let me go in that sex barn. So she looks through the keyhole and sees Christian's ass just going to town, and she freaks out. And then the other girls are trying to tell her it's okay, and then they all start collectively crying with her. So then you have you're juxtaposing the women in the sex barn are like moaning, then it's cutting to the other women crying with Danny.
Yeah, and she hasn't really gotten that before in this film. Like, even at the beginning when she's sobbing, Christian's just kind of, you know, there. Not really an emotional support of any kind, not necessarily crying with her, not saying he has to, but it's the idea that she hasn't had anyone to share in her grief.
Okay, so I don't think there's enough information shown in the film, but I think that this is deliberate to really get her on the commune side by seeing Christian has betrayed her, and that'll seal his fate.
They didn't do a really convincing job trying to keep her away from it.
Yeah, they're like, oh, because if you remember,
don't go down there. Okay, I guess you're going down there.
At one point, they say, we're going to have you meet with a matchmaker. And she never meets with the matchmaker. That's my opinion. I don't know if it's completely easy to read that or decipher that. So Christian, after he orgasms, he realizes, uh-oh, he's in trouble. He shouldn't have been doing that. And he freaks out and
runs half bonered.
Yeah. It's pretty comical, like, actually. And
this whole part of the film is very bizarre.
Yeah. He's running around and he hears all the women crying in the one barn, and he's like, oh, I'm not going in there. And then
always a good decision.
Yeah. So then he runs into another barn. Oh, wait. No. So he sees, what was it, Josh's like full leg sticking out of the ground, and he's like, that's not right. That's legs don't just grow out of the ground. I'm gonna run into this barn. And then in the barn he finds Simon's body, and then they knock him out, and then Christian wakes up, and Danny, you know, is given the decision to decide for the one person that will be killed in the barn or whatever. You know, it's either Christian or some other guy that whose name doesn't ring a bell. And interestingly, they don't show her pick Christian.
Yeah,
it cuts before you see that.
She instead just sports her, I would say, very iconic pouty face that she wears throughout a lot of the movie. I mean, the cover, the most common cover for this movie is Florence Pugh making like a face of anguish.
That's true.
Then you see, for some reason, Christian, who with whatever they gave him, he can't move at all. And then they decide to sew him up in a bear,
which, from what I read, apparently is like actually a good thing that's supposed to help you get close to Odin.
Yeah.
Yeah. So usually it was like a sign of actually like a good thing. But here it seems quite
not negative. Not the case. No. Yeah. So they have two volunteers from the commune, and they all go into this barn that they're going to light up. And the two that are there, they get some stuff put in their mouth saying you won't feel any pain. Apparently that's not true. They feel a lot of pain, and it's horrifying. So they all burn, and then you see people kind of like wailing in the background as like the people inside are burning, and you get kind of some interesting looks from Danny, and you know, that's the end of the movie.
And this is where like a lot of debate happens, because it seems like a very popular interpretation, because Danny's wearing her big ass flower dress, which is simply bitchin'. It's awesome. I would buy that.
Yeah.
She's wearing her big ass flower dress. Her asshole boyfriend, who we all agree, shithead deluxe, is getting burned up with all the other dudes who are also mainly shitheads. And then people take it that, so she's finally with a commune that shares her ideas of sharing, making all emotions communal and sharing your suffering evenly across everybody. And so some people, I think, see this as a happy ending because she finally, I was mentioning how her normal facial expression throughout this movie is pouting or like anguish. And here she gives a big old smile into camera. My personal feeling, though, and again, you know, I don't want to get into the intentional fallacy of trying to guess exactly what Ari Aster meant, but from what I know about like his thinking, and then also just from like the movie itself in the director's cut, which has a deleted scene, a couple deleted scenes that we didn't mention. One was just like, a superfluous, another ritual scene. And then a scene that came after it where Danny and Christian have an argument where he actually makes a couple good points about how she's, you know, can be manipulative. To be clear, I hate Christian. He's an asshole, coward. Danny, I would actually probably date Danny. She's super cute. She's super emotionally supportive, likes to love, likes little plants. She seems, you know, like,
yeah, she gave him a little, didn't she pick flowers and gave it to him.
Yeah. She's a sweetheart. She's a little emotionally needy, whatever. You can work with that though. She's a good person overall. That said, I do think that her emotionality, in effect, does become a system of control of the people around her. And at the end, like, it does become like a way of keeping everyone accommodating her. So that's her way of exerting control over this crazy world. Likewise, I think the cult, all these crazy practices, we forget that they're doing all this crazy shit because they think this will control the seasons. This will give them a good harvest. If all the women, like, fucking, I don't know, like all the wacky shit they're doing, like collecting their like menstrual blood and I don't know, like that, and burying it with a fish. Like, now we'll have a good harvest. They're all trying to exert control over like nature and their surroundings. And then at the end, you see, I love that they tried to tell these two guys from the commune, oh, we'll put this chemical in your mouth and you won't feel any pain. Turns out to be total bullshit, which is hilarious. Mm-hmm. They're burning, screaming alive. The commune then, like you said, it mimics their suffering, but Danny does not. She does not mimic their suffering. And when she gives that look into the camera, to me, that's more like Damien smiling into the camera at the end of The Omen, where it's like she won. Like, to me, it's like triumphant in that she played. She finally got everyone to sort of like accommodate her, and to she finally exerted her control and won this sort of like psychological battle, which again, I'd rather she won than her coward shithead boyfriend Christian. But to me, it's not purely happy. It's a, you just gratified and indulged a person in ways they should not have been so gratified and indulged.
It's very cathartic for her. It's a cathartic ending, no matter how you dice it.
I think part of it, so my interpretation is a little different, but
sure,
similar. So I took it more as like this ending is like bittersweet, that she won, but also in essence, she is trading one codependent relationship for another.
Yeah, totally.
And that she is not learned anything or developed any sort of skills for her to be on her own, be okay. She is just leaving the boyfriend for another group that's going to kind of placate her and that she can kind of like invest in, as opposed to her looking inwardly and trying to work on herself and being more fulfilled on her own terms.
I think she's more than willing to play her odds at that point, though. Like,
yeah,
she's got this whole community. She's shedding one toxic, emotionally unavailable person for a whole community that is kind of, from what she's seen, in it together.
Yeah.
And she's even got
very available.
Yeah. She's even got Pelly on the back burner as a little whatever bonus relationship.
Oh yeah. And he gave her a little smooch when she won the Maypole.
Yeah. Right. Got a little smooch, got a couple drawings from him.
Yeah. He looks like he does yoga. He's a fit guy. He's got nice hair. Like that's a good catch.
But yeah, no, I think it leaves a lot open to interpretation. What do you believe the meaning of the ending to be? And that it's very thematically rich, so that way you can come to multiple conclusions. I think I know a lot of people like what Liam was saying about it being seeming to be very triumphant. And I see that. It just, to me, I don't think it's necessarily a good or bad thing, just a complicated thing.
Yeah.
I think that's, for me, the more rich interpretation of just that there's a lot to take from that, good and bad.
Yeah, I mean, this whole movie is complicated. So for it to not have a complicated ending wouldn't really be doing it justice, I don't think. I love how open to interpretation it is. And, you know, Liam discussed at the beginning all of the little details around Danny's apartment and the decor and whatnot. And the large painting over her bed is actually a huge bear. And yeah. then with a little girl with a crown kind of like petting mm-hmm. the bear on the nose, kind of everything about it, all the tapestry, all the art, production, which design,
we didn't even get into, because
we could have a whole episode just devoted to that, you know.
Absolutely.
Jason, how would you relate this film in the way that it portrays cults to the other films that we've watched up to this point?
Well, obviously the first thing that comes to mind is Wicker Man, because mm-hmm. it deals with all the May Day festivities and the Maypole and, you know, the crops and the human sacrifice and the burning of the sacrifice at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that definitely comes to mind as an inspiration. I don't know if Ari Aster explicitly said it was. I haven't read up a lot on films that inspired it, but I know like Ingmar Bergman was a big inspiration for him.
I think it's interesting compared to like the other films we've brought up, how this cult, what we're left with is kind of not really, we're not quite sure what the intentions are as much.
Yeah.
Whereas the other films are more overtly like, these are bad guys. And
yeah,
this one, you know, we kind of talked a little bit about in the remake of Suspiria that there's where the film is left at, we're kind of seeing a more positive movement forward for that coven of witches that could be positive. But prior to that, that was, you know, the people in charge were bad people, evil, you know. And in this one, it's, you know, they do bad things, but like the intention and manipulation is left open. Like, it seems like they believe most of what they're doing and that it's, they don't see themselves as malevolent. Whereas I'd say a lot of the other films, they definitely see themselves as evil,
right,
or forces of evil that want to do harm to people.
And that's a good point. And this is also one of the first films we watched where the victims, if you will, kind of bring some of it on themselves. Like, they continue to take these, you know, drugs that make you hallucinate, and this tea and the mushrooms, and they're like open to making themselves vulnerable with people that have clearly shown, you know, that their motives, you know, might not be great.
And even Josh, who seemed the most respectful, or at least he took it the most seriously because it was his area of study, but he clearly didn't respect it because they said, don't look at our secret book. And he's like, eh. Second, you turn around, I'm going to go in there and look at your...
Yeah, you think he should know better of all
right. I do like that this one was kind of didn't say they were good or bad, because it's insulting when they say it's bad, like, oh, other cultures are bad. But it's also condescending when they're when movies portray like every Native American tribe was inherently like they were just nymphs running in the field who never had an unkind thought. It's like, nah, the Aztecs were beheading people. Yeah. Like, they were complicated people with their own motivations as well.
I think it's also interesting how, from like our outsider perspective, like, oh, they kill 9 people, and that, like, oh, it's wrong that they did this. If we look at our culture, there's a lot of collateral damage of people, other countries, people that get sick here that die because they don't have treatment for their medical issues, and we kind of just see that as being like, that's just part of the game, folks.
Yeah.
And if you went from like however many people die needlessly in like the United States versus this community, you know, 9 people every 90 years, their odds are a little bit better about, you know, if you thought about it. I mean, obviously, they're decidedly inflicting harm, as opposed to it being kind of an outcome of a system
of indifference.
Yeah, that's an interesting take. So when you think of it from that angle, John, we got to pose the question, would you join this cult?
You want to go with me first?
Well, do you need more time to make up your mind?
Well, it's just, we had a very interesting, thoughtful discussion, and my answer will be, you know, equally as thoughtful. You know, honestly, watching the movie, it just seems very hot there and sunny. Mm. There's no, I'm a night guy. All right. I was a little upset that no one had sunglasses. I'm like Mark. I was like, oh, there's ticks everywhere. There's probably no air conditioning. Could I charge my computer.
I didn't see anyone listening to a podcast.
No. And they probably, and you know what? They seem so elevated that they would be like, we're already happy. We don't need podcasts to distract us from the hell that is our lives. So, you know, honestly, they have no use for me. I would be unhappy. It's a no.
That's disappointing. I thought they had you with this one, John. No. Honestly, I thought you were there, but it came down to sunglasses, which you could have packed your own.
Why didn't anyone have sunglasses? It looks so brutal. It's bright.
I didn't. It never looked hot to me, though. It looks comfortable. It looks comfortable.
No, there's no shade.
There's certainly no air conditioning.
Yeah, there's no shade. It doesn't ever get to be nighttime where you like get some time away. Like you're going to be living in that barn and everyone else is there. The babies are crying and like 50 more years and then I can die of old age and be done with this. You know, it just, yeah,
I want the commune that lets me live in an Airbnb.
Yeah.
Yeah, Liam. So John's angle on this is typically how easily he thinks he can take over the cult. How quickly he thinks he can get
this would
to the
be
top.
A hard this would be a hard one.
Yeah, so this one will be tough. So I get that from that angle. John, I'm surprised you didn't think of it from the angle of you could be like the Pelly type. You could be like at your apartment for most of it and then come just for the festivities.
Oh, that's a good point.
You know what? That's a good idea. I thought you were going in a completely different direction with that, and I thought you were gonna say I pretend to be like the next Reuben, and I was gonna be like, Jason, that's really inappropriate and horrible of you to think that.
The cult for me, I don't know, I'm not really into blondes, so not my thing.
Okay.
So that's a no.
Easy enough.
Honestly, that was the most concise Liam has been anytime I've talked to him.
About anything ever.
Yeah. All right, Jason, would you join this cult?
It's going to be a no for me, and I'll tell you why. Yeah. I would love to visit Sweden someday, but not under these circumstances. I don't know what my role would be. It seems like the ladies kind of have a lot to do, and the dudes are kind of just there.
They're tending to the fields.
Yeah, I guess so. The food doesn't look great.
Oh, that's, really?
That's a big deal. Oh, Liam's like, give me the pube pies. Oh,
well, not the pube ones, but like the non-pube
It's a nice change of pace as it has less hair in it.
Yeah. And and I don't love the idea of sleeping in a room with a bunch of people. I'm a very light sleeper. Mm. And if that's part of it, it's a no for me. So I don't know why I needed multiple reasons, but there I gave you.
I'm glad that none of your reasons from both of you were we don't want to kill people. It was instead was like, ooh, the sleeping arrangements.
Yours was you don't like blondes.
Fair enough.
Zing.
I'm allergic to bear fur. I could never do it.
All right. Anything else, gentlemen?
Yeah. Hey, guys. Thank you again for having me on. I'm sorry I broke your show, but I really had a great time, and this is a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks for coming on the show, Liam. I know this film, we could probably talk about it
we could do like five episodes on it for sure.
So yeah, no, I, you know, this is a fun one to talk about. I know we're all on the same page as far as, you know, our thoughts on this film and kind of how much of a masterpiece it is. So it was fun to discuss it with you guys.
Great movie. Better podcast.
Better friends.
Oh! All right, that does it for this week's episode. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Next week, we will be reviewing The House of the Devil.
At the Stupa.
Jason, you're supposed to say something.
Stab you later.
No. You're supposed to say, oh, that's going to be a good one or some shit like that. And then I go, yep. And stab you later. And then we move on. So
what? When did we discuss that?
We don't discuss it. You just do it every time naturally.
You always say stab you later. You took that and you ran with it.
Okay. Yes. But when I give the little pitch to rate, review, and subscribe, then I mention something about the next episode. And then you're like, oh, that's going to be a great one. Or
that- I just glad I could bear witness to all
this. Yes. Yeah. He's acting very different around you, Liam.
I'm sorry.
He's so much sweeter when it's just him and I.
You guys know I'm like a sweet guy who does nice things. Yeah. And like loves you guys.
All right.
I don't want to be a temptation for evil. But.
All right. Next week, we will be reviewing The House of the Devil. All right.
I have a feeling that's going to be a good episode.
That was terrible, Jason.
What do you want me to say? This isn't something we normally do.
All right.
What are you talking about?
Stabulator. We're keeping
that's
this all in.
That's gonna be a good one.
All right. Well, fuck you all.
Oh, shit.